on today's Run to the Top podcast.
You can't just say if you've had a bad night's sleep, you're going to perform badly. In fact, a lot of athletes that I work with who are probably the poorest sleepers, they're actually the best performers. And the reason for that is it's this theory of hyperarousal. So we've all had the experience of you can't shut your head off because you're just thinking of stuff over and over again. This happens more often than not in these like wired people. So the stuff that I'm trying to do is make sleep education and sleep management more specific to the individual who are basically wired. So those are people that get their sleep disturbances the most. What can we do to help them basically de-arouse themselves before bed?
Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast from Runners Connect, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. Together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now here's your host, Tina Muir.
Hello, this is Tina Muir. Thanks so much for joining me for the latest episode of the Run to the Top podcast brought to you by Runners Connect. Last week, we heard from the one and only Jay DeSherry, who gave us fantastic advice about how we can work on our imbalances and put our bodies in a place where we feel healthy and strong, rather than a ticking time bomb, which I know I definitely used to feel that way, and I feel so much better now I don't have to worry about that. I don't know if that makes any sense to you guys, but if you are feeling like you're always on the verge of injury, make sure you go back and check that one out. Today, I thought it was about time we went back to approach the topic of sleep. Now, we did have Dr. James Mars on last year, and I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes. James is one of the world-renowned experts on the topic, but today we're coming at it from a little bit of a different angle. Luke Gupta is our guest today, and he might not have all the products and a pillow named after him in Bed Bath & Beyond, which, by the way, I did buy that pillow and I quite like it. But he is the one right at the center of all the research. He is specifically focusing on sleep and performance. And let's just say I was surprised with what he shared with me during this interview. You're going to love this one. And Luke gives lots of actionable tips to actually help us shut our brains off at night. Or am I the only one that struggles with that? I am hoping and guessing I'm probably not the only one. But either way, you're going to get some great advice from him. All right, that's enough from me. Let's meet Luke. I want to say a big thank you to Body Health for sponsoring this podcast and for helping me with my training over the last few years. You can enter to win a pack of 6 Perfect Amino bottles for free by visiting runnersconnect.net/bodyhealth. Thank you to Saucony for supporting the Run to the Top podcast. Running might be a low maintenance sport, but a good pair of running shoes is a must. Use coupon code TINA for 10% off at saucony.com when you pick out your next pair. Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. This is something that's really interesting and something I definitely have taken a lot of interest in. And I love that we finally have someone who we can kind of pick their brain about this. And I love that you're English as well, of course. But first, just for anyone listening, you're a physiology PhD student and a sports science technician. You specialize in sleep and athletic performance at the English Institute of Sport, which I'm quite excited to hear more about. But that must be kind of a highly sought after position trying to get that kind of level. So firstly, I'd love to kind of hear how you got into it and how you got this position here right now.
Yeah, so I suppose I started off at university studying sports science, and quite a broad topic, as you can imagine. It obviously covers lots of disciplines such as psychology, physiology, strength and conditioning, nutrition. So I kind of started there, studied all those things quite broadly, and then physiology took my fancy because I kind of liked to understand how the body works. So that kind of pursued my passion into physiology. So I went to do a master's at Loughborough University. And then while my master at Loughborough University, I did a few work placements with the likes of British Swimming. Loughborough University have their own sports science department, which I worked in for about 6 months. And then during that time, the IS advertised a position for sleep. So sleep's one of those areas where it doesn't really fall within a discipline. It kind of sits outside the realms of your traditional sports sciences. So everyone was at the moment trying to grab a piece of it. So you've kind of got, it kind of can sit anywhere really, because you can't say it's a physiology thing. You can't really do sleep with physiology without understanding the psychology of sleep, for example. And obviously, there's lots of things in nutrition which can impact sleep as well. So you kind of have to have quite a holistic view towards sleep. Mm-hmm. So when that came out, I kind of jumped at the opportunity, really, because like you said, it's quite a niche area, which not many people, particularly in the UK, have really kind of delved into in any detail whatsoever. Yeah. The opportunity to kind of potentially become one of those people was just, yeah, it was a really good opportunity for me. And I took that. And then I'm 4 years down the line now, currently writing up my PhD, hoping to hand in probably about 4 to 6 months' time.
Very exciting.
So hopefully, yeah, that'll be all done and dusted. And then we'd have to see what happens with sleep in England, to see where it goes in terms of research, the application of it with elite athletes. It's really just, we're starting to get the ball rolling a little bit. So through my PhD, we've unearthed lots of different things I haven't had the time really to go in and research, because it's not really part of my PhD, but I can imagine this area is just going to get bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of reaffirmed that this is the area you want to go in as you've learned more about it?
Yeah, I think so. I've still got a underlying passion for generic physiology, particularly in team sports, which was kind of my growing interest, because I'm a field hockey player by trade, but I do a lot of running in the summer. So I'm kind of a seasonal runner, I suppose. Don't really run in the cold. But yeah, so that's still kind of a passion of mine. But yes, sleep is something that I've kind of, as I've developed over the years, I've become more and more interested. Now I can't really see a career without it, to be honest. So mm-hmm. I think it's always going to be part of whatever I do. And I still want to kind of keep the research side of what I'm doing going, because like I said, I've only just really got started.
Yeah. So we're going to go into your research and what you have found in a minute. But firstly, just maybe if you could give us kind of a glimpse into what life is like with your job and maybe some of your favourite parts of it when it comes to working with elite athletes, when it comes to sleep and performance.
Yeah, sure. So my role is split in two areas. One at Loughborough University is where when I'm there, I'm kind of a PhD student. So I'm kind of heading the books, writing, reading, meeting with different people, trying to get my PhD done. But the other part of my job, I'm working at the English Institute of Sport at Bisham Abbey. So here we've got Great Britain rowing, hockey, canoeing, and I think those are the major ones that are based here. Oh no, I'm now recently the women's rugby team based themselves here. So we've got those sports based here. So my job is really to provide physiological support, mm-hmm. Not to every sport, but some sports may want a project in. So for example, recently I've done a project with one of those sports looking at adapting to the heat before they go and compete somewhere. So we've been doing a lot of heat work in a heat chamber, which you've got here, which can go up to 40 degrees Celsius. So I've been doing that this afternoon, actually. So
that's like how the heat affects their sleep?
Not necessarily sleep. This is more just for generic performance.
Okay.
My main role is sleep. I still kind of delve into little parts of physiology. So that's kind of one part of my role. The other part of my role, as you just said there, is mainly sleep. So in the lead up to the Rio Olympics, I worked with, I think it was over 33 sports in the end, basically going into different sports and kind of just looking at what sleep looks like in those sports and trying to make not any drastic changes, because that's probably the worst thing you can do before the biggest competition of your life. It's kind of making subtle changes to make people feel more comfortable with their sleep. So when they get to Rio, they felt like they were in control and everything they could do with their sleep was kind of already been done. Mm-hmm. So they could worry about other things when they got there. So that was probably my main role in the lead up to the Olympics.
Okay, so then what kind of things, just give us some examples of things that you did work with on people for this. Like, how did you get them to feel more comfortable and like their sleep was taken care of, like you said?
It's mainly education, really. So people in general, athletes or non-athletes, have quite a what we call a literacy of sleep. So that basic understanding of sleep is quite low. Sleep is one of those things that it's not, the information about what it is, what it does, how it works, isn't readily available to the general public. So if you ask anyone about sleep, they don't really know the intricate details. But generally, people know their sleep because they've been doing it since the day they were born. They know the feeling of sleep. They know what a good night's sleep feels like, what a bad night feels like. And within squads, you get people that pin like performance on it to a different extent. So you get some people that fundamentally believe that sleep is crucial for their performance. So if they don't sleep well, they fundamentally believe that they're going to perform badly. Whereas you have others who believe that it doesn't really matter. So they can sleep really badly and then still perform quite well, or at least feel like they perform quite well. So my main role was to go into squads and upskill them or educate them on the basic science of sleep. Also kind of dispel a few myths around what people believe about sleep, and also really kind of just give them details on how sleep can affect performance, what it is, what it isn't, and essentially kind of dispelling any anxiety that people have about sleep. So athletes have the opportunity to ask questions about what was worrying about their sleep, what do they think it does for their performance, and I was able to kind of provide really generic messages that are taken from a branch of sleep science that's been around for probably 50, 60 years now. It's not necessarily a new science in the world of sleep medicine, but within sports science, it is new. Mm-hmm. So the types of messages we were bringing in was kind of just stuff that's been around for quite a while now, but it's just kind of translating that and applying it to athletes whose context of how they perform and do stuff is slightly different to the general public.
Oh, okay. And then did you see a difference between across the sports, like different, you said about the different approaches that people have individually, but did you see differences within the sports?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So sports, within sport, like some of my research recently found that there's big differences between sports and how they sleep and how they perceive sleep. So if you look at sport type broadly, you've got your endurance sports, like your runners, your rowers, your triathletes, and swimmers. So how those guys sleep is completely different to say how an aesthetic athlete, like a gymnast, a synchronized swimmer, how they sleep is different. Mm-hmm. So if you look at runners and triathletes, for example, typically at the elite level, they're getting up very early to train, purely to fit in the volume of training in which they have to fit. They have to get up early. So because of that, they almost shorten their sleep by just adhering to schedules. Mm-hmm. So from that, they're carrying over like a bit of a sleep drive throughout the day. So they're naturally quite sleepy people. So you find that endurance athletes nap a lot in the daytime and they don't take very long to fall asleep, and they usually report very good sleep quality. Whereas if you ask another athlete, like a, let's say a shooter or an archer, who don't tend to have the schedules that, say, endurance sports have, plus the amount of, let's say, energy they expend when they train is great, they're the ones who tend to have sleep problems. They're the guys who don't seem to sleep that well. Obviously, you can be an older athlete quite easily and still compete in that sport to quite a high level. Whereas, let's say in rowing or a cycling or a triathlon, obviously those types of sports have lifespans because it's such a grueling, brutal attack on your body that essentially you're going to retire at a certain age. So there are fundamental differences based on how sports are exposed to different stresses in the elite sport environment. So training schedules is one, long haul travel is another, stress before competitions another. So there's a whole host of things, I suppose, in the elite sport environment which athletes get exposed to different extents, which can make them at risk of having poor sleep. But also there's the fundamental traits, like your personality traits, your genetic traits, which you're kind of born with or develop through adolescence, which almost pre-select you for sports. So let's go back to the endurance example of runners and swimmers again. Swimmers fundamentally get up very early in the morning to train.
Yeah.
If you were one of these people that like to lie in the morning and go to bed really late at night, you're not going to survive in a swimming program because you're going to have to be, let's say, let's call it a morning type person.
Yeah.
You're going to have to like performing in the morning because otherwise you won't be able to keep up with the program. So that's kind of one side of it as well. You kind of get your personality and genetic traits almost predispose you to participating in a certain sport. And that's where it gets interesting. So those traits which predispose you to be, let's say, a swimmer or an elite athlete in general, they may also predispose you to have sleep problems. So we know that elite athletes are quite perfectionists in terms of they want to be the best they can be. They tend to be quite anxious, some of them quite anxious people, because they want to be the best, and sometimes that's not always the case. Some things don't go right. So you kind of get these profile of personality traits that also might predispose them to sleep problems. So my research has kind of delved into that in some way to try and understand that a bit better. So are elite athletes almost predisposed to sleep problems just by being an elite athlete, or is it there a certain group of athletes within that population that's, let's say, more predisposed because of the elite sport environment in which they train in. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I definitely see this. And I could imagine like a lot of what you're talking about, especially with, like you said, the endurance athletes and the personality traits. Even, you know, a lot of our listeners, I'd say most of our listeners are not elite athletes. And I don't want you guys to think that, oh, well, this doesn't apply to me. Anything, you know, Luke and I talk about today, this doesn't apply. But I'm sure a lot of you guys know that the traits he's describing, the get up early in the morning, the perfectionist, the want to be the best you can be, you still probably have a lot of those in there. And yeah, maybe, okay, you haven't reached the world level, but I'm sure, Luke, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of these probably will be able to be applied to, like you said, the sport in general, not just the top level athletes here. Before we go on.
Yeah, that's probably one thing I should have mentioned is the challenges that athletes face, although they're fairly unique to that population, but the underpinning mechanisms that disturb your sleep are no different to the general population or recreational athletes. You could argue that the challenges that the recreational athlete faces might be even greater than the elite athlete in some cases, because they've got to fit in work. Obviously, there's family life, which obviously digs into both populations. Mm-hmm. So yeah, essentially, so my early research has kind of suggested that although the elite athletes have like these stressors, you could call them, that challenge their sleep, students, university students, are no different in the sense that they have to get up early for lectures. They have stressors like exams.
Yeah.
Recreational athletes, the same way, if you're about to run the London Marathon, for example, for the first time, you're going to be anxious the night before. And that's no different to an elite athlete being anxious before, let's say, an important competition. Mm-hmm. The mechanism that disturb their sleep, exactly the same. So while I'm talking about elite athletes, that's basically my world and what I relate to. But essentially, this kind of goes down from elite athletes to recreational, like even to non-athletes. The things that disturb sleep are general amongst the modern day human being, not just necessarily athletes in general.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to go into your research in a minute, but as you just were kind of talking about that, you said about some of the myths that you hear of over and over again about sleep. So maybe if you could just go over a few of those and kind of what the reality of them is, the ones that you hear quite often.
Yeah, of course. So the biggest one, I suppose, is around sleep duration. So we all hear about the magic number of 8 hours that everyone thinks they need to get. And if they don't hit that number of 8 hours, then they've had less sleep than they need. So where 8 hours has come from is an average of 7 to 9 hours, which is what the average or the range, I suppose, for human beings in general. Mm-hmm. But doesn't mean that you sit within that range. There are anomalies. So you get people that could get by on 6 hours, sometimes even 5 hours. You hear reports in the media of people sleeping for 4 hours. But on the other spectrum, you have other people that may need 10 hours sleep or even 11 hours sleep. It's highly individual. So sleep duration isn't a number which you need to hit that is generic for everyone. Everyone will have their own amount of sleep which they need to hit. And it doesn't have to be taken in like one night phase. It's what we call in sleep medicine is total sleep time. So it's the amount of sleep you get over a 24-hour period. So you could, for example, nap for half an hour in the daytime and have 7 hours at night. That means your total sleep would be 7.5 hours. So it doesn't have to be all taken in one phase. So that's kind of a generic myth that you have to have 8 hours sleep to kind of function and like be healthy on a day-to-day basis.
So can I just ask you quickly before you go on? So when you said about it's highly individualized, so if someone listening right now is like, okay, well, how do I know what mine is? Because you hear of people saying, oh, I'm tired today because I overslept or I slept too much or I feel fine at 6 hours, but you know, maybe it's impacting them. How can people kind of know where they fall? Is there a way of like, just, I feel like I had a good sleep, or you sleep that amount, a certain number of days in a row? What would you suggest?
Yeah, it's a tricky one really. So there's no, even like all the technology we have out there, there's no like one thing you can pin, like something you can measure that says like, that was amount of sleep I needed.
Yeah.
So it kind of goes back to the mantra which we kind of chant in sports science is which happens is to listen to your body. So
yeah,
in the evening, if you feel sleepy, we do it all the time, people kind of feel sleepy, then they kind of ignore those feelings of sleepiness and kind of do something else because they want to stay up later, which is fine in most cases. Stay up late all the time, it'd be quite boring if you just kind of went to bed early and when you felt sleepy the whole time. But generally the rule of thumb is if you go to bed when you feel sleepy and you sleep until you feel refreshed, that's generally a good sign that you've slept enough. But again, like you said, it gets complicated because if you, say, had a bad night's sleep one night, the next night's sleep, you're probably, given the opportunity, you probably sleep a bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to kind of explore it a little bit. Like you said, people can sleep for too long. These general feelings of lethargy, if you spend a long time in bed, makes absolute sense. If you lay down for a long period of time, you're going to get up feeling quite groggy. So it's kind of a mixture of sticking to routine. So once you kind of know generally how you feel when you know you've had enough sleep, so let's say, for example, it's 7.5 hours for someone, and obviously you've got your schedules to fit into that as well. So, for example, if you're a shift worker, obviously that doesn't apply to everyone, where you can take your sleep in one hit. You might have to take in a couple of hits, or you might have to sleep at different times of day. So although your sleep need may be a certain number, it may be restricted by the demands of society.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of still goes back to knowing your body and kind of listening to it. So like you said, people know when they slept for too long. Likewise, they know when they haven't slept enough. I know, because we do this every night, you kind of get an experience of this. So people don't really, they kind of take sleep for granted sometimes, where you kind of, you just sleep and you wake up and you go to work, you train, you go back to sleep, and you don't really kind of pay attention to what's really going on, how you feel your sleep, etc. So my advice would be probably to pay attention to your body, how you feel, not just when you wake up in the morning, but around your bedtime as well. So usually, because we're kind of creatures of habit, we're unbelievably good as human beings of anticipating when stuff happens. So if you go to bed at the same time every night, you will feel sleepy at that time every night, because your body's kind of almost entrained to that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you find out at the weekend, for example, which is a good place to experiment, that when you give yourself a chance to sleep for longer, if you end up sleeping, say, 2 to 3 hours longer than you probably did in the week, the likelihood is in the week you're not getting enough sleep. Whereas if you kind of slept in at weekends and you find you only slept in for an extra, say, half an hour, maybe an hour tops, then you're probably doing it about right. So two things really there. So you've only got to listen to your body in terms of feelings of sleepiness and how you feel in the morning, but also kind of when you've got opportunity for sleep for longer, try to notice differences. And sometimes it's difficult to do, because the way our schedules are and train into us through training patterns, through work, through family life, sleep in the week naturally gets restricted.
Mm-hmm.
People sleep longer at weekends, but the extent to which people sleep longer will depend on how much sleep you kind of get in the week.
Okay. So then what about if you have an early flight, you have to get up at 4 a.m. and you didn't sleep well the night before because you were thinking about getting up.
Yeah.
Is it better to try and catch up? Like you said, like maybe the next few days add a bit extra. Should someone nap if they could, or just kind of get on with the day and go back to bed at that normal habit time?
Yeah, it's a very good question, actually. So that's kind of another, not myth, I suppose, but it's kind of a habit that people feel they kind of need to adhere to, is when you have lost sleep, you kind of accumulate what we call like a sleep debt, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Repay that debt. So let's say you've slept 2 hours less than normal. It doesn't necessarily mean you need to repay that 2 hours back the next night.
Okay.
Sleep doesn't really work like that. It's quite an automated process, in the sense that if you've had a bad night's sleep one night, the next night's sleep will more likely than not be better, given the opportunity. That's just how sleep works.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really need to do much. It's when you start interfering with sleep is when things go wrong. So the less you do with sleep, the better it works. So if you had like a bad night's sleep because of an early morning flight, for example, my advice would be just to crack on as normal and kind of just continue your normal routine. Maybe allow yourself, like, if it was like a big loss of sleep, then obviously lying in for a little bit is going to do you some good. And if you can nap in the daytime, a short nap again will obviously add to that sleep time. So some people can tolerate sleep deprivation very well. So sleep deprivation is basically just a loss of sleep. Some people can lose a lot of sleep and function very well throughout the day. Other people can lose sleep and they feel like they've been hit by a bus. It feels awful, and they really can't cope with it. So there's very big differences in terms of how people cope with it.
Okay.
But generally, adhering to your routines, you'll be fine. Okay. It kind of adjusts on it by itself.
Okay, great. And so once again, we are learning, listen to your body and don't compare yourself. We hear this over and over again in running. So there's just another lesson with this. And any other myths that you hear often that you would like to mention before we go on?
Yeah, so a lot of them, or particularly going back to the sleep duration one, is you could go on for other hours, actually. But I suppose the other one is going to bed early is not necessarily means your sleep's going to be better. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people think that if you go to bed early, it's quite ingrained in our society that you, particularly for kids, for example, you tell kids to go to bed early, or like, I'm going to bed early tonight because I've got an early start the next day, etc. People tend to believe that if you go to bed early, you're going to sleep better. And that's not the case. Sometimes it can actually cause sleep problems. So if you go back to the routine thing where we're saying stick to your routines, going to bed earlier. So athletes do this all the time before competition, because they feel like they need to sleep well before, let's say, an important run the next day, or like a marathon or a race, whatever. So they go to bed early to try and get more sleep than normal because they believe it could have some kind of effect on their performance the next day. But what tends to happen is they end up lying there for longer than normal. Mm-hmm. And because they're not falling asleep, they get stressed. And because they get stressed, they can't fall asleep. And it's a vicious cycle. It goes round and round. And before you know it, you've been lying in bed for quite a long time worrying about not getting enough sleep.
Yeah.
By the action which you thought was meant to cause you to get better sleep. So you kind of put yourself into a bit of a hole. So again, it goes back to the root, the thing of like, if, for example, before competition or like before anything, really, if you want to get up early, you might as well stick to your normal routine. Okay. Take the hit a little bit. You can tolerate a bit of sleep deprivation pretty well. And like I said before, you can carry that over to the next night and you'll probably have a much better night's sleep the next night. Trying to kind of manipulate sleep schedules, what we call that, when you go to bed, when you wake up, messing around with it a bit too much can kind of cause more problems than it causes good.
All right, then I want to ask you a little more about your research in particular, because I'm sure people are going to be interested, and you know, everyone seems to love the science here. So maybe go over, you know, your research on the role of sleep for performance and what you found, you know, how motivation changes, effort changes, and, you know, physiological changes that you've noticed.
Yeah, sure. So my PhD is looking at trying to identify athletes that are more prone to sleep disturbances than others. That's kind of what I said a bit earlier. So my PhD hasn't really looked at how sleep impacts performance. Mm-hmm. But I've obviously read quite a lot around the area, and it's one of those areas which I don't think there's a clear-cut relationship between sleep and performance. There's a lot of research out there which has been done in laboratories, for example, where they've done complete sleep deprivation. So they basically take away sleep entirely for one night, maybe two nights, and they look at the impact on performance. Mm-hmm. So believe it or not, not sleeping for 2 days puts you in a pretty bad place and you don't perform well in any task. But the research where you kind of disturb sleep slightly in a real world scenario, one is quite difficult to do, particularly with, say, athletes before important events. And two, it's, disturbing someone's sleep in different ways. So how your sleep's disturbed may be very different to how my sleep is disturbed. Mm-hmm. Let's say you could wake up a lot in the night, whereas I could have problems falling asleep. So it's not so clear cut in the sense that how sleep is disturbed and the impact on performance is very complicated. So you can't just say if you've had a bad night's sleep, you're going to perform badly. In fact, I know a lot of athletes that I work with who are probably the poorest sleepers, and they're actually the best performers. And the reason for that is something that is a big part of my research, is this theory of hyperarousal. So hyperarousal is, I suppose, in layman's terms, those people who are just bouncing off the walls all the time. They're just wired. They can't shut down in the evening, and all day they're kind of, you know, the person's chatty all the time. They're always kind of the life of the soul of the party, etc. They're those types of people. So those type of people, they're very good at performing in the day because that's just how they're wired. So they can get their arousal system, which is a part of your brain that causes us to be awake. They can get that firing on all cylinders and more in the daytime, which allows them to basically perform at their best. If you look at team sports, a big example of that, where that's very advantageous, goalkeepers, American football, baseball, even in long distance running, that can be beneficial if you can sustain attention for long periods of time because you've got this like wired arousal system. Mm-hmm. be great. So that's good for short-term performance, but it's very difficult for people to shut down because they're just constantly going. So my research is basically try to identify those people through a battery of tests. And you don't really need a battery of tests. You know who these people are. They're kind of the ones who, they're just, like I said, bouncing off the walls all the time. But also, you also get certain traits of their personalities, the certain way they sleep. There's some certain aspects which kind of make them, you notice these people for more scientific, rigorous assessment, which I've done. So I come up with a battery of tests which identifies these people. And I'm basically trying now to kind of put these interventions in place, which takes away some of this pre-sleep arousal, we call it. So you're it's basically like anything that basically keeps you up at night, I suppose. So it could be anything you're thinking about. It could be your heart's racing because you've trained late, your muscles feel tense. All these things are sources of arousal. They just manifest themselves differently. So we've all had the experience of you can't shut your head off because you're just thinking of stuff over and over again. Everyone goes through that. So this happens more often than not in these like wired people. So the stuff that I've tried to do is make sleep education and sleep management more specific to the individual who are basically wired. So those are people that get their sleep disturbances the most. What can we do to help them basically de-arouse themselves before bed?
And what are some of the things you've found help?
There's lots of things, really. There's one major one, which is very simple, and it seems a bit counterintuitive, but it's basically going to bed later. So the way to kind of make yourself feel sleepy is stay up late. So the way sleep works is the longer you stay awake, the sleepier you feel. That's one of the rules of sleep. And the other rule of sleep is what we call a circadian rhythm. Mm-hmm. So every biological system behavior in our body will have a certain pattern over 24 hours. So for example, let's say hunger. Most people are hungry in the morning, then they get hungry in the afternoon, and they get hungry again in the evening. So you have these peaks and troughs throughout the day. And it's the same with body temperature. Your body temperature goes up, it goes down all throughout the day. And sleep's exactly the same. We sleep at night and we stay awake in the daytime. So these two things kind of intertwine, form basically what we fundamentally call sleep science. So to manipulate the rule that the longer you stay awake, the sleepier you feel, for someone who's got arousal or like thinking about stuff, they can't switch their head off, their heart rate's going, they can't wind down, staying awake for an extra hour or two will basically, one, give you more time to relax and let that arousal dissipate. So I'm not going to provide examples of how to relax because that's so highly individual. So a lot of people like to read, a lot of people like to watch TV, a lot of people like to do their own thing to relax. So that's very highly individual. But essentially, it's delaying sleep times, so making yourself go to bed later. Mm-hmm. Also, ensuring you have a period of, let's say, 30 minutes at least where you're doing something that is relaxing prior to trying to sleep. So the biggest thing what happens with people, particularly when they compete or train late at night, is they get home from training. This applies to elite athletes and recreational athletes and people who work late as well. And because it's gone past their normal bedtime, they basically try and quickly as possible try and go to bed.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to get enough sleep. So like I said, it seems quite counterintuitive, but actually having some wind down time or delaying sleep by, say, an hour or so, ends up going to bed later. But the quality of sleep, because you haven't gone to bed in a stressed state, is just so much better.
Yeah.
So you might sacrifice an hour, half an hour of sleep, but because you're not stretched, you're probably not waking up at much at night, and you basically feel more rested when you wake up because the quality of your sleep is now much better. So that's probably one of the simple interventions of which we kind of use with athletes. Again, it's not rocket science in a way. Again, it's just, again, like I said at the start, understanding how sleep works and the science of sleep. So if you go remember those two rules of the longer you stay awake, the sleepier you feel, and well, everyone knows if we go to sleep at night and we stay awake in the daytime, you can kind of manipulate sleep quite cleverly to help yourself, particularly when you get stressed.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense, and actually very interesting. I have spoken on the show before about, I've actually been to a sleep therapist. I am unfortunately one of those wired people you talked about, and I can definitely attest to the staying up later. That was one of the tricks we used, was the sleep restriction, where I wasn't allowed to go to bed before midnight and, you know, was trying to keep my eyes open by the end, but had to do it and get up at 5 and restrict it for a few days and then slowly push my bedtime back. And so I definitely found that helps, and also was kind of like a reset as well each time I did that. So I would say, if you are struggling with sleep, to try that. It definitely would help. And I think we've all done that, where we've tried to force ourselves to go to bed when we aren't ready. And what would you say? So if someone did try to go to bed and their mind is buzzing, or is it better to just get up and, you know, go out of the room and relax for a bit and do, you know, read a book or watch TV or whatever, like you said? Or is it better to just keep trying to sleep, even though, you know, obviously you're getting yourself more and more worked up thinking, you know, when am I going to fall asleep?
Yes, you've nailed it on the head there. So, yeah, you said something very interesting there, which is something called make an effort to sleep. So, like I said before, when you try to do anything with sleep, that's when it tends to go wrong. So there's something in sleep medicine called the attention, intention, effort pathway, which is something where basically it means that when you try to sleep and it doesn't quite work, you start to attend to negative thoughts around the consequences of not being able to sleep. And yep. Which
counting
in itself,
down how many hours you have left.
And that in itself causes more cognitive arousal, which prolongs your ability to fall asleep even longer. So you're kind of breaking the cycle is quite a simple thing to do. So if you can't get to sleep within, say, 15, 20 minutes, or if you notice that you're lying there and you know you're not going to go to sleep because your head's buzzing or your heart's racing, whatever, you feel just uncomfortable, you just don't feel quite right because of something might have happened before. You might have an argument with your partner, something might have happened that's caused you to be stressed. Getting out of bed and doing something relaxing, even sitting up in bed, changing your position if you can't get out of bed. If you can just sit up in bed, do something different and relax, read, watch TV until you feel sleepy again. When you notice those feelings of sleepiness kick in, again, don't like rush to bed as quickly as possible to try and sleep. Obviously that will kind of wake you up again, but just kind of gradually go back to sleep again, and then before you know it, you'll be falling asleep. And if you do that, if you're one of those people that kind of this happens to a lot, if you do that repeatedly over time, you kind of create this like behavioral association with only keeping your bed for sleep. Mm-hmm. So a big mistake that people make that who can't sleep very well is that they do a lot of waking activities in bed. So they may eat their dinner in bed, they may watch TV in bed. Everyone does watch TV in bed. It's not necessarily the baddest thing in the world. But if you've got a sleep problem, then sometimes keeping your bed for sleep only can be a big help. Because it almost like tells your body when you get into bed, it's time to sleep. Whereas if you're doing other things that you normally do when you're awake in bed, your body doesn't really know when it's time to sleep, when it's not to sleep. Mm-hmm. Light exposure is massive when it comes to sleep. So our whole physiology is dictated by the sun and when it sets and when it gets dark. So if you can make it dark, so when you relax, if you can't fall asleep, if you do it in dim lighting, it's going to help things better. If you have a bright light shining in your face, then obviously your body's going to think that the sun's up or something, and you're not going to fall asleep as readily.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then let's talk about some other sleep aids. As you mentioned the light, I will say I do use those melatonin light blocking goggles, the orange glasses, and I will recommend those. I will put a link in the show notes to those, and also what I have found has helped me if this is something you've struggled with, and you know, as I have focused a lot on this, but give us some advice as you are the expert with, you know, what other things work. Like, let's maybe go into melatonin. Is taking that good, or taking like sleep aids? Is there any issues with those for repeated use?
Yeah, so the whole sleep aid, I think there's a time and a place for it. For example, sleep medication is probably the most, I suppose, clinical, I suppose, sleep aid. And there is a time and a place for it, and they are safe. They do what they say on the tin. And melatonin, the same. It does what it says on the tin, and it is safe. But I suppose when the problems come in with any external aid, when it's asleep, is that if you use it repeatedly, you almost create some kind of dependency.
Yeah. So let's say
you have a gizmo. I've seen these like pebbles you can put under your pillow, apparently, and it makes you sleep better. Let's say you use one of those, and you notice that you do sleep well because of it. It might be not because it's that per se, but just having it there makes you sleep better. Let's just say, for example, over time you keep using it and using it, and then let's say you lose it for whatever reason, and all of a sudden your sleep goes to pot because that thing is not there anymore. So that's the same with anything when it comes to like long-term kind of dependency on sleep aids, whether it's medication, melatonin, whether it's doing something else, it requires an external something to help you sleep. That's when it gets a problem. And some of the techniques and stuff that we try to use here at Loughborough University in the IS is, it's almost like internal techniques. So stuff you can do in your head, which you can take anywhere in the world with you. You're not relying on something external, which basically makes you feel better to fall asleep. You're in control. So when you feel like you're out of control or something else is controlling your sleep, that's when it can go wrong. So when you're taking, say, melatonin sleep medication repeatedly, you're not necessarily in control of your sleep. You fundamentally believe that it's that thing that is making you sleep.
Okay.
So that's when sometimes it can be a bad thing. But for example, let's say you're on a long haul flight and you're on there for 24 hours and you can't sleep on a plane and you want to sleep. Taking a sleeping pill then is a very sensible thing to do, because no one can really sleep on a plane because it's cramped, uncomfortable. You've got people in your personal space everywhere. So that's a perfectly acceptable place to do it, I think. And it can work if you're going through a really bad patch of sleep, let's say for months, for example, when you really need to break the cycle, then that's when it's used in that way. I think that has a place for it. But yeah, I would say like external aids like melatonin and sleep medication are probably like a last port of call. There's a whole host of things you can try, which is very behavioral and cognitive. By cognitive, I mean stuff you can do in your head, really, that basically can help you get into a really relaxed state and help you sleep. Because essentially that's what you need to do when you sleep, is do nothing.
Yeah.
So if you can like not think about falling asleep and not really think about the consequences of sleep the next day, that's when sleep happens. If you ask someone who doesn't sleep very well, why don't you sleep well? They'll give you every reason under the sun why they don't sleep well. If you ask a good sleeper, why do you sleep so well? They probably won't be able to tell you, because it just happens for them.
Yeah.
Because they didn't really do anything. So when it comes to sleep aids, I think the more you can have control of it, the better. For example, a very good thing to do, which is readily available, I think you can download apps for these things now, is something called progressive muscle relaxation.
Okay.
So it's a series of exercises where you go through each muscle in your body, from your hands to your lower forearms to your arms, and you basically you tense them as hard as you can for say 5 to 10, say 5 seconds, and then you basically let go, and you notice the sensation, the relaxation of your muscles. Mm-hmm. And you basically go through this process through every muscle in your body, and then when you get good at it, you can do this in bed, and what you tend to find is that your whole body just feels completely relaxed and your muscle tension is completely gone. And because you're focusing on tensing muscles and not really thinking about anything else, before you know it, you feel like you're 6 inches deeper into your mattress and you've fallen asleep. So that's an example of something that I would say you could argue as a sleeping aid.
Yeah.
But it's something that you're in control of. It's not something that you're putting into your body or something that you need to be there for you to be asleep. It's something that you're doing. You're in control of it. And that's why that technique is particularly effective.
Okay. Any other ones that you would suggest, you said about behaviour?
There's some like things you can do in your head. So like counting sheep, for example.
So that does work?
It's an old wives' tale, but yes, it does work. It doesn't have to be counting sheep. So anything that you can, like there's certain breathing exercises. You're breathing, like noticing the air go through your nose or even through one nostril and out the other nostril, which sounds ridiculous, but obviously it's impossible. But if you really visualize that happening, you're kind of taking your mind away from other things that's worrying you or the thought process of sleep. And before you know it, because you've got bored of doing this activity, you've fallen asleep. So these they're not necessarily distraction techniques. They're kind of, I suppose it's a type of mindfulness in a way, where you've taken your mind to a place which isn't kind of worrying about other stuff, which kind of has got you to a bad place in the first place. It's kind of allowing you to relax in your own way. And these techniques don't work for everyone. This is just, I'm just reeling off things at the top of my head here.
No, it's helpful.
So reading's a perfect one. Reading is lots. If people like reading before bed's brilliant, because it's, as long as it's like a horror book or a action thriller where you're kind of getting yourself worked up. But stuff like that can be really effective. So I would much encourage looking into those like techniques as opposed to investing money in kind of sleeping aids. Okay. They can work for some. Again, melatonin ones where it can get quite complicated because you have to look at the dosage when you take it, and that's a lot of effort. Whereas if you can just breathe through your nose a few times and fall asleep, it seems a lot easier. So there's different things you can try before you.
No, that's great. Although I have one question for you. So sometimes when I'm falling asleep, and you said about falling like feeling like you're 6 inches more into your mattress, I find myself thinking, any minute now I'll be asleep, because I can tell I'm relaxed, but I think any minute now I'll fall asleep. And then of course what happens when you think that, but then you start being like, okay, well it's all right, I'll be asleep in 5 minutes. Well, I'm not asleep yet. And then it starts, you know, building back up again. So how do you stop yourself if you get in that thought? This is a bit of a selfish question, but I'm sure I'm not the only one thinking this.
Well, I suppose that's a type of sleep effort in a way, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
You're kind of saying, right, it's about to happen. I can't wait for this to happen. And you're getting a bit excited about it. So I think like if you do start to do that and it doesn't quite happen, having some sort of like mind trick, or not mind trick, that's probably doing it a disservice. It's kind of if you could develop some kind of technique where you can take your thoughts away from that thinking,
okay,
then I think that would definitely help. And you might have to play with it a little bit in terms of what it is. For you, might be counting backwards from 100 or something like that. Mm-hmm. There's different things you can try. But for some people, that in itself is too cognitively arousing because you're thinking of just too hard. So again, it's highly individual what works, what doesn't. I suppose it goes back to, if you take it back another step, understanding the consequences of you not falling asleep at that moment in time. What is the actual consequence going to be in reality? Probably not a lot. You're probably going to get up, if you don't fall asleep, walk around for 15 minutes, sit down, do something more, 15 minutes, you lose half an hour of sleep. But like I said before, because sleep is an automated process, what happens is you carry that sleepiness through to the next night and you have a much better night's sleep anyway. Mm-hmm. So you can always take confidence from the fact that if you don't quite fall asleep readily as you want to, or you don't have quite a good night's sleep generally, you have the confidence in the fact that the way sleep works, that the next night, within the next night after that, you'll probably have a better night's sleep. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really matter that much if you don't.
And that's very similar to what my sleep therapist said. So interesting to hear the same thing. And then just before we go on, I just have a few more little questions about it. Based on your research, what did you find on sleep and performance? Like, just how important is this to performing well? I mean, you mentioned the people who are like wired and they tend to be the best performers, but is it completely individualized like you mentioned, or is sleep like critical for everyone?
For performance, I think it can indirectly have an impact on performance, but I suppose the biggest impact it can have is on well-being. So people always, like, I suppose, they underestimate the effect of sleep on well-being. So, for example, you could have a poor diet, or you don't exercise very much, and I suppose that will take months, even years, to manifest itself as a poor life choice or something that has an impact on your health. Whereas sleep, if you have a bad night's sleep or two nights sleep, you know immediately that you haven't slept well. You're moody, your mood changes, perception of effort goes up during training. We all know that. So you're kind of, your physical performance doesn't change that much, but your well-being does. So let's say that happens repeatedly. What happens is your ability to adhere to that training on a day-to-day basis becomes much less, because we know that if you don't sleep very well, for example, it's that much more of an effort to get out of bed to go and train in the morning. So if you haven't slept very well, the last thing you want to do is get out of bed and go for a run. If you've slept really well, you probably jump out of bed immediately and go for a run. So we know it can almost like change that side of things. And we know that it can increase your susceptibility to illness. So if you don't sleep very well for long periods of time, you're more susceptible to colds, et cetera, like that. So obviously that can take you out of training for periods of time. So they can have an impact on performance that way. That's more of a, like a training long-term view, but it could also have an impact on your night before performance or the actual performance through anxiety. So not sleeping well can increase anxiety, which may increase anxiety before performance. And if you're a particularly anxious person, if you're over anxious before a race, you might not perform as well. Whereas if you're not an anxious person, then obviously it won't really affect you. So it is highly individual in terms of how it affects performance, but it's not a like I said before, it's not like a clear cut. If you don't sleep well, you don't perform well.
Okay.
And like I said, these people that tend to be wired can override these feelings of sleepiness in the daytime. So if you're in a sport where you have to sustain attention for a long period of time, so a marathon run, for example, if you can't sustain attention for a long time because you haven't slept very well, then that may change your pacing strategy. You might make a bad decision. Mm-hmm. You may go off too hard. So that it can affect things that way. But physiologically, it may not have that much of an impact. But like I said before, it's a really complicated area. It's very difficult to connect one to another. So there's no really cause and effect going on here. We don't know really what how it impacts performance. I've seen studies where athletes that finish like at the top of rankings in events sleep the worst, and the ones who finish lower down sleep the best. So there seems to be some exceptions to the rule here where not everyone has to sleep well to perform well. But okay. The matter of fact is, yes, everyone sleeps, and the better you sleep, I suppose your well-being will be much better for it. So if you have better well-being, you're more motivated to train, your adherence to training sessions are better because you don't take time out because of fatigue, illness, motivation. So it can affect performance that way, but not necessarily directly performance.
Okay. So if someone is, you know, getting ready for the night before a race, they aren't one of those like wired people that we've kind of talked about, but they're thinking, okay, you know, you said it's not directly tied to performance other than through anxiety, but what about, you know, if I'm going to spend all night stressing, like, you know, should they just kind of accept and say, okay, it's all right, you know, I'm only going to get 6 hours sleep, and just kind of accept it? Or how can they approach it without kind of doing what you talked about earlier of the like going to bed too early thing, if they know they've got to be up at 4 a.m. or 3 a.m. for their marathon? Like, how can they prevent that becoming an anxiety?
Yes, it's a very good question. So if I go back to what elite athletes do, so night before competition is the most disturbing stressor, I suppose, mm-hmm. for sleep in the elite sport. A large majority of athletes have poor sleep before a competition if it's important to them. And the ones who sleep well before a competition, you probably start questioning what their relationship to that performance is. So it's probably not that important to them if they can sleep really well because they're not really thinking about it. So
yeah.
If you're about to race the most important race of your life, naturally you're not going to sleep well because you're not going to be relaxed because you're going to be worried. So you can take comfort that your sleep might be disturbed, but so will every other athlete in that rest of sleep will be disturbed as well, because that's just how sleep works. If you're thinking, it doesn't have to be anxiety, just thinking about your performance will can delay sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so accepting it's quite a good thing to do, and normalizing it to other people, normalize it and kind of say to yourself, if you've slept well, that's another good thing too, which I forgot to mention, is kind of sleeping well before a known period of disturbance. So there's some recent research has come out saying that they call it sleep banking, which is physiologically impossible. You can't store sleep. But basically what it's saying is that if you optimize your sleep in a period up to a known night of disturbance, so let's say you know your sleep is going to be bad because of an early morning get up and worried about competition the night before a marathon, for example. If you've had, say, the nights before that have been pretty good, you can take comfort in the fact that that one night is probably not going to have much of an impact at all on your sleep. Whereas if you've had like quite a long period of bad sleep leading up to that event, then that's a different story. But so ensuring you give yourself adequate opportunity to sleep leading up to the event is probably the best thing you can do. So for example, they would say you need to get a good night's sleep before the event. I would argue that it's probably the days leading up to the two, even one day before competition that are probably more important, because inevitably, because of scheduling, worry, your sleep will be disturbed. You can't really get away from it, unfortunately, which is quite a good message to give out to people, because that way they almost expect it to happen. So when it does happen, they don't feel like, oh God, I can't fall asleep. If they know it's going to happen, then it kind of, that reduces anxiety in itself.
Okay. And I could imagine, like, you know, if you're traveling somewhere for a race and you have the opportunity, you know, so let's say you get to somewhere either the day before or 2 days before, you know, you're in a new place that's going to bring up a load of like new stimulation that might keep you up. But if you get good sleep the week of the race before you travel, then, you know, you feel confident. And then if you don't sleep in this new place where there's all this new stuff, then oh, well, you know, I'll be fine because, you know, you've kind of banked it up. So I think, yeah, I think that's very good advice there. And then just before we get onto the final kick round, do you have any future research that you plan on doing that we can kind of keep up to date with?
Yeah, so I've recently published like a literature review, which is readily available out there. I'm happy to provide you the link.
I'll put a link in the show notes for sure.
And then I suppose, yeah, because I'm writing up my PhD, I've got a few more studies that are probably on the brink of being submitted for publication. So, and I suppose they're more to do with some of the things what we've talked about. So between sport differences in sleep quality. And I suppose it's the latter end of my work is a bit more confidential given my associations with elite athletes, etc. But yeah, in good time, that will be, I hope anyway, it will be published. So yeah, in terms of how my work's going to go moving forward, I suppose I don't really know myself, but essentially I'm still interested in sleep. And there's so much I haven't done. So a lot of stuff I've spoke to you about tonight, not necessarily part of my PhD. My PhD is more about identifying vulnerable sleepers. All the stuff I spoke to you about has been more about stuff I've read around the topic through my reading. So yeah, to answer your question a bit more concisely, it's providing, I suppose, a package of education techniques to athletes, which they can use anywhere in the world to help them sleep better.
Yep.
That's kind of what I want to do next year.
Okay, great. I will put all the links in the show notes at runnersconnect.net/RC147. And just for anyone listening, what would be the best way for people to follow you? I will put that lit review up, but would you say Twitter is your best?
Yes, Twitter's the best place.
Okay. Yeah. And what is your Twitter handle, just for anyone listening?
It'll be LukeGup86.
GUP86. All right. And I will put a link in the show notes. Okay, we're just going to take a moment to thank our sponsors and we will be right back for the final kick round. By now, you've probably heard me talk about how a Body Health Perfect Amino is the perfect blend of the 8 essential amino acids to help you build and repair your muscles, your tissues, and of course, improve recovery. I take it along with their complete Plus Detox multivitamin. And during my recent marathon build-up, I took Perfect Amino a few times a day, which allowed me to bounce back from my workouts quicker and to keep training hard so I could have a good race in the fall, which is kind of important, right? Have you used coupon code TINA10 yet? The Body Health team would love to hear your feedback. Yes, another reason I love them. And you can share your experience with Perfect Amino through the show notes for this episode by visiting runnersconnect.net/bodyhealth. Oh, and you can enter to win a 6-pack worth $230 there too. So once again, that link is runnersconnect.net/bodyhealth. I wish you all the luck. This is the time of year many of us commit to being better and doing what we can to reach our goals. For me, it's doing more stretching and mobility work, and you've heard me admit it here, so hold me to it. But once the busyness of life, the nasty weather, and the tiredness from training accumulates in our legs, that motivation slips away, and it can be really hard to get it back. Now, we could reward ourselves with food, but after all that indulging over the holidays, most of us probably need to work on making better choices. We all know that new running shoes or new running clothes have a bit of a power to get us excited about running again, especially if they look stylish. The Saucony Freedom ISO has become my new favourite shoe, not just because they're nice to look at, but because the Everrun sole gives back with every step. So even on my most tired day, I feel like I'm getting a little bit of a push from the ground. I absolutely love them, and I think you will too. So if you live in the US, make sure you use coupon code TINA to get 10% off your order at Saucony.com. Okay, Luke, just 5 more little questions for you, starting with the greatest advice you've ever received.
So the greatest advice I received was quite recently, actually. It was when you have a setback, there's no bad experiences. And that relates to training that I do, academia, just life in general.
Yeah, I love that.
You always learn something from a setback.
Yeah.
Always look at it positively.
That's great. Yeah, definitely. Okay, favourite running book or blog?
Running book would be Ultramarathon Man.
Okay.
I'm a trail runner in the summer anyway. I'm quite keen on like adventure running, and I've done a few mountain marathons in my time. Oh, I've done one actually. So I want to do another quite soon.
Cool. Yep, that's a good choice. What would you like to tell, if you're going to say, if we say a new runner who, you know, is maybe concerned about if they're getting enough sleep?
I suppose you've probably heard this quite a lot already. I would say listen to your body.
Yep.
When it comes to sleep, though, it's slightly different. I suppose when you take it into the context of your training as well, it can be really powerful. Your body tends to know what it's talking about. So if you wake up and you don't particularly feel like running, then there's probably a reason for that. Okay. So don't ignore the signals.
Mm-hmm. Very true. All right. What is your pre-race meal when you do run?
It's quite specific. It's a toasted wholemeal bagel with peanut butter, banana and honey.
Good choice. That's actually probably quite a popular choice within our listeners. So, good choice. And finally, favourite running product?
That would be my Polar RC3 GPS watch.
Okay.
It's got me out of quite a few sticky situations where I've got lost.
That's always helpful. Okay, Luke, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And we've learned so much today. I look forward to following along in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
How interesting was that? I don't know about you, but sleep absolutely fascinates me. And I have to admit, the last time we did the sleep episode, I ended up sleeping worse for a while because I got myself in that mode of I have to get sleep. And we know what happens when that happens. We talked about it in this episode. But this time, after I talked to Luke, I felt confident and I've actually been sleeping pretty well. So hopefully that continues for me and hopefully you guys get some great sleep too. Now, if you're interested in hearing more about what my sleep therapist taught me about sleep, I did mention that in the interview, I'll put a link in the show notes to my personal blog post about it, in addition to what Luke and I talked about today and some of his research studies. So you can find those at the show notes at runnersconnect.net/RC147. And I just want to remind you, have you checked out the daily podcast yet? In case you haven't, I haven't been doing a very good job at my community manager job, if that's the case, but these are mini episodes for Runners Connect podcast. It's called The Final Kick. So Run to the Top, Final Kick. They're 10 to 15 minutes long and we answer your questions that you either call in or email in. And it's been live for a few weeks now. This week is actually my week for answering questions. So if you head over to runnersconnect.net/daily, you can find episodes 11 to 15, plus the other 10 episodes so far. And if you have a question that you would like one of the coaches to ask, or even if you would like to ask me, you can specify it there. You can submit your question at that link. And I'll also put a link to the daily podcast in the show notes, which again are at runnersconnect.net/RC147. Next week, we are going to be talking to my sports psychologist, Evie Cerventi, and I cannot wait for you to meet her. So I'm not going to say any more, but just tune in, trust me. Thank you so much for listening today. I really appreciate that you've chosen to listen to Run to the Top, and I hope you have a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from runnersconnect.net.